KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
We know how important COVID vaccinations were, both for pregnant women and for children.
What does the government's new guidance on COVID vaccines mean for people who want to get the shot?
For Wednesday, May 28th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, how President Trump approaches other countries from a position of deal-making more than traditional diplomacy.
Where Trump is much less successful, much less comfortable, is when there's a genuine conflict of interest.
Also in our series, here to help the former Surgeon General on volunteering as a cure for loneliness.
What service reminds us is who we really are. It's a reminder that who we really are is actually not always what we see online or in the news.
And people on social media point to lots of things as recession indicators.
Our Planet Money team asked economists which ones really are.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. A federal judge has ruled a lawsuit can move forward alleging Elon Musk and Doge are illegally wielding power over government operations. Here's NPR's Stephen Fowler.
Several Democratic state attorneys general say Elon Musk has been illegally given similar power to cabinet officials without being confirmed by the Senate. Judge Tanya Chutkan found the plaintiffs provided enough initial evidence to allow those claims to continue. The ruling highlights the often conflicting descriptions of the power Musk and the Doge entity have been given to implement President Trump's agenda, and how efforts to downplay that power in court have been undermined by public statements and actions. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Atlanta.
President Trump has named an envoy to Syria, the latest sign the U.S. is rebuilding ties following that country's recent revolution. NPR's Greg Meyer reports Syria is looking to recover from a long civil war.
Trump announced that Tom Barrack, the current U.S. ambassador to Turkey, would take on the additional role of envoy to neighboring Syria. For now, the U.S. embassy in Damascus remains closed. It's been shuttered since 2012, a year after Syria's civil war erupted. The war ended when longtime dictator Bashar al-Assad was ousted last December. The U.S. and other Western countries are steadily reestablishing ties. During a Middle East trip 2 weeks ago, Trump lifted U.S. sanctions against Syria and met the country's new president, Ahmed al-Shara. While the war has ended, Syria's economy is in shambles, and most Syrians are living in poverty. Greg Myrie, NPR News.
In a post on social media, Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the U.S. will begin revoking the visas of some Chinese students. Rubio saying it would involve, quote, those with connections to the Communist Party or studying in critical fields. The latest move adds to the current uncertainty for international students. China is the second largest country of origin for international students in the 2023-24 school year. More than 270,000 international students were from China. Transportation Secretary says operations at airport in Newark, New Jersey have improved, but as NPR's Joe Rose reports, Sean Duffy's still pushing for billions of dollars.
Air traffic operations at Newark Liberty International Airport are running better since the Federal Aviation Administration capped the number of flights last week, Secretary Duffy said. The airport, which serves New York City, had experienced hundreds of delays, cancellations, and diversions in recent weeks because of equipment outages, runway construction, and staffing shortages. Still, Duffy reiterated his call for Congress to fund a new air traffic control system.
I'm concerned that we could have more Newarks.
Duffy wouldn't say exactly how much money the administration is seeking, but he put the price tag in the tens of billions of dollars, and he called it the most critical infrastructure project in the country. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 244 points. This is NPR. A Peruvian farmer and mountain guide has lost a landmark climate change lawsuit against one of Europe's largest power companies. The farmer had spent nearly a decade arguing the company should help fund flood defenses near his home, citing its role in global warming. From Lima, Simone Tulio reports.
A court in Germany today ruled that the probability of a lake of glacial meltwater overflowing and devastating the home of Saul Luciano Yuya was too small for energy giant RWE to be held liable, but environmental activists are still claiming a win. They say the court ruled on the specifics of this case while accepting the broader principle that climate change plaintiffs from around the world can sue German companies over their carbon emissions. For NPR News, this is Simeon Tagle in Lima, Peru.
Scientists say they've identified a new cluster of ancient people they say appear to have lived near the land bridge between North and South America roughly 6,000 years ago. They say the group lived in the high plateaus in an area that is the present-day Bogota, Colombia. Because they aren't necessarily linked to Native Americans in North America or ancient or present-day South Americans, scientists say they're still trying to figure out exactly where they fall in terms of the human tree. The pod of ancient people appears to have faded away some 2,000 years ago for an unknown reason. The finding is published in the journal Science Advances. Crude oil futures prices moved higher today after OPEC and allies opted to, at least for now, leave output policy unchanged. Oil rose 95 cents a barrel to settle at $61.84 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Now that the federal government has stopped recommending the COVID vaccine for healthy children and pregnant women, will those shots still be available to people who want them? And will insurance cover it? Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. did not answer those questions in the one-minute video where he announced the new guidance yesterday.
I couldn't be more pleased to announce that as of today, the COVID vaccine for healthy children and healthy pregnant women has been removed from the CDC recommended immunization schedule.
Dr. Peter J. Hotez is here to help us understand what this means for people's access to the shots. He's dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine, and he was part of the team that worked to develop a low-cost COVID vaccine. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Oh, thanks for having me, Ari.
What's your initial reaction to the new guidelines?
Sort of shock and disappointment because we know how important COVID vaccinations were both for pregnant women and for children, although for different reasons. In the case for pregnant women, first of all, you know, as anyone who was working in an intensive care unit between 2020 and 2023 knows, pregnant women did not do well with COVID, the virus. On average, they had much higher rates of severe illness requiring hospitalizations or even intensive care unit monitoring, and sometimes they didn't survive. The data that we have so far suggests that if pregnant women were vaccinated against COVID, it had multiple benefits, predominantly including, you know, by one analysis suggesting a 94% reduction in hospitalization for pregnant women who got vaccinated.
So that's pregnant women. On the question of healthy children, FDA Commissioner Dr. Marty McCarry said most countries have stopped recommending these vaccines for kids. Is that true? And if so, does it make sense for the U.S. to follow?
You know, I think one of the problems with the way the current leadership of the FDA looks at COVID vaccines is very much the way they portrayed it when they were talking heads on Fox News, which is they were only looking at one parameter, which was case fatality rates or infection mortality rates, which of course are much lower in children, although a significant number of children do die annually from COVID. But here's the part that they really missed the ball on, which is the impact of vaccinating children for long COVID. There was last year a very important study showing significant benefit for both children and adolescents, and both the Delta wave in 2021 and the BA1 Omicron wave in 2022 are preventing long COVID. So in their calculus, it doesn't look like the FDA at all is considering the impact of long COVID.
If somebody still wants the shot, despite the federal government's recommendation, is insurance likely to cover it?
So this is where I'm going to give you a pretty, I don't know the answer to your question answer, a pretty long one, which is, I don't think we know. First of all, you know, usually it's not the FDA signing off on the public health use of a vaccine. This is why we have a Centers for Disease Control. This is why we have an advisory committee of immunization practices known as ACIP to make those recommendations. So the decision on how the vaccines are used are typically made in collaboration between ACIP and the CDC director. And that's often the basis for recommending the vaccine for the Vaccines for Children's program, for the insurers. And all of that now has been bypassed. So I think we're in kind of an unknown territory now. What does it mean that the FDA has skirted all of that, or Health and Human Services, and just kind of made this unilateral decision, which on top of that is not evidence-based? So question one, what do the pharmacy chains do? Do they continue to offer vaccines for pregnant women or for kids? What do the pediatric practices do? That's question one. The next question is going to be, will the insurance companies cover it? And then, if that weren't confusing enough, if you remember the leadership of the Food and Drug Administration, Dr. McCarry, the FDA commissioner, and the head of CBER, the Center for Biologics Evaluation Research, Dr. Vinay Prasad, issued a guidance document where they specifically said that pregnancy is, quote, a risk factor for warranting vaccinating individuals who might not otherwise qualify.
And just to be clear, if it isn't covered by insurance, it's pretty expensive, right?
Well, it certainly can be. I know this. I was not very happy when Pfizer and Moderna, after they took a lot of U.S. taxpayer dollars, they jacked up the price. I think at the last look, it was around $130 a dose. So that is a significant expense for a lot of people.
So bottom line, what is your advice for people who want to be as protected as they can be?
Certainly, if were my daughter or loved one who was pregnant, and I'd be very, and there was a lot of COVID transmission, I would strongly suggest that they get vaccinated to protect themselves and protect their soon-to-be newborn infant. For an adolescent or a child, if you're concerned about long COVID, I would also recommend keeping up with annual immunizations.
That is Dr. Peter J. Hotez, co-director of the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development and dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine. Thank you.
Thank you.
When President Trump talks about his foreign policy, he often frames it as a business deal. He says much less about conventional diplomacy, things like building relationships and mediating conflicts. NPR's Greg Myrie has this look at the art of the deal versus the art of diplomacy.
President Trump is threatening to abandon peace efforts in the Russia-Ukraine war. And he isn't saying much about the Israel-Hamas fighting either. Yet Trump is quick to tout international economic agreements. On his recent Middle East trip, he said the region is now being defined by, quote, commerce, not chaos.
Where it exports technology, not terrorism, and where people of different nations, religions, and creeds are building cities together, not bombing each other out of existence.
Stephen Walt is a professor of international affairs at Harvard. He said this reflects Trump's preferred narrative on foreign policy.
Business deals are Trump's comfort zone. It certainly fits his self-image that he's a master deal maker, a master negotiator.
But Walt and other foreign policy analysts stress an important point. You make deals with allies who have similar interests. You do diplomacy with rivals who have opposing interests.
Where Trump is much less successful, much less comfortable, is when there's a genuine conflict of interest, when you're trying to produce a lasting ceasefire in Gaza, when you're trying to come up with an actual end to the war in Ukraine.
Trump rarely, if ever, addresses the soaring civilian death toll among Palestinians in Gaza. When he mentions the territory, he usually talks about the U.S. taking control and building luxury beachfront properties. Stephen Cook at the Council on Foreign Relations says successive U.S. presidents, Democratic and Republican, have tried to refashion the Middle East as a more peaceful, democratic region and largely failed. Trump shows no real interest in such lofty goals.
The president essentially dispensed with the kind of overambition that has marked American foreign policy in the Middle East. We are not interested in remaking societies. We are not promoting democracy.
Trump's agenda is limited and transactional. But Cook thinks this is more realistic and will likely keep the U.S. out of major entanglements. Here's how he sums up Trump's approach.
These societies can develop and pursue their politics as they see fit without the intervention of the United States, which has been destabilizing over the course of the last 30 years.
Cook does have concerns. The Mideast remains volatile. Trump relies heavily on one envoy, Steve Witkoff, his friend from their days in New York real estate. Witkoff, who had no diplomatic experience, is handling nuclear negotiations with Iran, the Gaza War, and the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Cook says Trump is overestimating what Witkoff can deliver.
He is miscalculating when he thinks that the deal is a deal, whether it's about a luxury hotel or it's about Iran's nuclear program or it's about a hostage deal and ceasefire, that these are all the same. They're going to run into problems because the president wants to go with his gut.
In the Russia-Ukraine conflict, Trump also emphasizes deal-making. He pressed for a minerals agreement with Ukraine, and it was recently signed. Jeffrey Pyatt, a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, supports the agreement. He worked on a similar effort when he was the ambassador there a decade ago. But one business deal won't end a war with a long, complicated history.
This war has its origin in the agenda of one man, Vladimir Putin, and his sacrifice of hundreds of thousands of Russian soldiers who died in pursuit of his territorial ambitions.
Pyatt retired in January after 35 years at the State Department. He fears the U.S. is shortchanging its own diplomatic clout, particularly with Russia. European leaders are talking about ramping up sanctions on Russia, while Trump has been speculating about future trade deals with Moscow.
European leaders have clearly signaled that as long as Putin continues to ignore calls for a ceasefire, they are prepared to raise the cost. The Trump administration does not appear willing to do the same, at least up until now.
In recent days, Trump criticized intensive Russian airstrikes, called Putin crazy, and threatened more sanctions. But he hasn't taken any action. Stephen Walt says Trump should be skeptical of U.S. adventures abroad. But there's also a risk of abandoning hotspots where the U.S. could play a key role.
I fear that on all of these places where there's a serious conflict of interest, something that's hard to resolve, the United States is likely to be absent without leave.
Diplomacy, like business deals, has its own costs and benefits. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Time for our series, Here to Help, which looks at service and community in America. When we put the call out for your stories of volunteering or those of someone in your community, we got more than 200 responses from all across the country. You nominated volunteer librarians and scout leaders.
You told us stories of volunteering in food pantries, municipal boards, and community compost groups. Here's just one example. Leah Lawson from Asheville, North Carolina, called in.
I'm nominating my friend Allison, who is now the founder of Appalachian Community Relief.
She says when Hurricane Helene hit, Allison Hargis jumped into action.
She pretty much immediately went to the Ingalls parking lot in Black Mountain and just started helping people. She became like the point person for relief in that area. She has a three-year-old. She has a family, and she just did everything to make sure that her community was taken care of, and like at the expense of like her own needs. Like, the girl couldn't even shower. Like, we didn't have cell service or anything.
Daniel Luthi from Washington, Illinois, volunteers for the Red Cross, and he wrote in to say, being a full-time registered nurse, volunteering is my outlet to do other things in the community. It helps keep me engaged in my community, and I feel strengthens my mental health, he said.
Many of you wrote us to say that volunteering connects you to something bigger than yourself, and that is something our next guest has been thinking about. Vivek Murthy served as the 19th and the 21st Surgeon General of the United States. Before leaving office in January, he wrote his parting prescription for America, in which he highlights the benefits of volunteering. I asked why he felt compelled to explore this.
This parting prescription was my effort to answer a nagging question. What is underneath the deeper sense of unhappiness that so many people feel that I encountered across America? Mm-hmm. And I realized that there were three elements that we all need for fulfillment in our lives: our relationships, a sense of purpose, and engagement in service.
Murthy says of all the advisories that he issued as Surgeon General, this one really seemed to strike a chord, yielding direct emails from strangers.
They were very interesting. They're very personal emails that said, I've been feeling this sense of emptiness in my life and couldn't quite put my finger on what was missing until I read this. Or I've been trying to think about how to raise my kids to give them the best chance at living a happy and fulfilled life. And I feel like here I have perhaps the beginnings of a blueprint and how I can do so. So it's been really quite substantial, the feedback, but very gratifying to see that these elements are in fact resonating with people.
I mean, what you're calling for sounds noble. It's hard to argue with. It sounds so good. Is there specific one or two things that you would point people to who may not be going to read the whole prescription right now, but are thinking, yeah, I could get on board with that?
Well, here's what I would say. Nobody is opposed to having good relationships, but if we look at how we're living our lives, more and more society is pushing us in a different direction of substituting online relationships for what used to be offline in-person relationships.
So true.
For substituting short forms of communication, a quick text here or there, for an actual substantive conversation with somebody where you can really understand who they are. Mm. So for anybody out there who might be listening and might be thinking, I've been struggling maybe with loneliness or lack of community or feeling that sense of emptiness, one place we can start is to actually look at our own relationships and ask, can we spend 15 minutes a day reaching out to somebody we care about to have a conversation? During that conversation, can we give them the benefit of our full attention, not be distracted by our devices? And most importantly, can we find a few minutes in each day to help someone else? Those small acts of service, as seemingly small or insubstantial as they may be, are extraordinarily powerful in forging greater connection for us and another person.
So we did a call out to people to share their stories as part of this series. And I want to share one of those moments that we got back with you and get your reaction. This is from Colleen Texera Moffitt. She is a volunteer at the Greater DC Diaper Bank.
When things feel a little chaotic and out of control globally in my own life, like it, I always feel good when I've left, 100% of the time.
I mean, to that point, she always feels good when she left. That's very much in line with what you're saying. To those who are skeptical, you know, the need, there's so much need. There's so many challenges, so many crises. How much can an hour, 2 hours of volunteer work do to solve those problems? How much can it matter?
Well, a little bit of service goes a long way in terms of its impact on our community, but also in terms of its impact on us. For an individual, the data is increasingly clear that service has a positive impact on our physical health, reducing our risk of heart disease and our overall mortality. It has an impact on reducing mental health symptoms as well, particularly depression and anxiety symptoms. It also actually improves our cognitive function. We find strong associations there in the data. But when it comes to loneliness and building community, service is one of the most powerful antidotes we have to loneliness. Look, this is a time where many people are reading the news, looking around them, and feeling a sense of despair about the world. They're feeling drained by the conflict and the polarization we see around us. And I must say, so many people say to me, Mary Louise, that it feels like the world has gotten meaner, like we care less about each other. There's more cruelty around us. What service reminds us is who we really are. It's an opportunity for us to experience kindness and compassion. It's a reminder that who we really are is actually not always what we see online or in the news, but no one's covering the story of the person who's volunteering at the diaper bank, the person who's rolling up their sleeves and helping kids and teachers in a school who might be struggling. But those are the moments that we connect deeply with another person. And those are moments that remind us also that we have so much to give to the world.
Vivek Murthy, your latest tour in government came to a close in January. You're back in civilian life. So let me put the question to you. Are you volunteering? Tell me a story from your own life.
Yeah, so I've been looking at how I live my life now that I'm a civilian again, and a big part of it has actually my realization has been that I need to spend time helping other people and supporting other people. And one of the things that helped me realize that was not just this parting prescription, but a few months before I ended my tour of duty, I got a late night call from my friend DJ. I'm just calling to check on you. And I was surprised. I thought he needed something. He said, "Look, I know that you're going to be transitioning soon, and these can be hard. These life changes, and I just want you to know I'm here for you, and I want to know how I can help." And I was so touched. So I'm now trying to do that for others who are transitioning as well, either leaving government or who have lost their job and are trying to find a new job. I find that we can be the help that each other needs. We can be so much of the relief and that we seek. We can find that in our relationships with each other. And sometimes we think, hey, I can't really help somebody else because I can't fix their problems. And this is something I think is so important to underscore. You don't have to fix someone's problems in order to support them and help them heal. Simply by showing up, by listening to someone, we can remind them that they matter and that they are not alone in their journey. And that's what my friends have done for me. It's what I'm now seeking to do for other people as well.
Well, thank you for showing up and sharing these thoughts with us in our studio today. Nice to see you.
Thanks so much, Mary Louise. Good to be with you.
Vivek Murthy, he served as the 19th and 21st Surgeon General of the United States.
This is NPR News.
The Central European country of Hungary, it doesn't have the typical trappings of an autocracy. People here say repression shows up in subtle ways.
It's having your favorite newspaper shut down. It's people being afraid to post online.
Why then are American conservatives gathering here this week on the next Morning Edition from NPR News?
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, we'll meet K-pop's most unlikely boy band.
Its members include defectors from North Korea.
Do you think it'll be cool to, like, do a K-pop group with some North Koreans? Why not?
That story after this summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. The Trump administration says food security is national security, yet concerns remain that the administration's efforts to downsize the federal workforce could put U.S. agriculture at risk. NPR's Andrea Hsu has more.
American agriculture has been relatively free of pests and diseases that have afflicted other parts of the world. That's thanks in part to the federal workers at the U.S. Department of Agriculture who work to protect the nation's plants and animals. Kevin Shea worked there for 45 years before retiring in January.
That gives us a trade advantage with the rest of the world, and it also creates an abundant and comparatively the cheapest food supply around the world.
But now Shea fears the departures of hundreds of key staff could leave farmers and ranchers vulnerable. In a statement, USDA said Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins is working to make the department more efficient while not compromising its critical work. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
The Israeli military has killed a senior Hamas leader and military commander in Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made the announcement today while speaking to Parliament. NPR's Adil El-Shaouchi has more from Tel Aviv.
Mohamed Sinwar became the de facto leader of Hamas in Gaza last year after the Israeli military killed his brother Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas at the time. Earlier this month, the Israeli military carried out a series of airstrikes around a hospital in Khan Yunis in the south of Gaza. Israeli media quoted defense officials saying that Mohamed Sinwar was the target, but the military is yet to confirm. The Israeli military only said that there was a Hamas command and control center in the hospital. Hamas did not immediately confirm if the strike had killed Mohamed Sinwar, who has survived multiple assassination attempts over the past decades. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
And you're listening to NPR. British prosecutors have released a list of 21 charges against social media influencers Andrew Tate and his brother Tristan. As Villa Marx tells us, the brothers are accused of rape and human trafficking in the UK.
Britain's Crown Prosecution Service said it authorized the charges last year before an arrest warrant for the Tates was issued. The brothers are dual British-American citizens, widely known online for their misogynistic stances. In February, they flew to Florida on a private jet from the Romanian capital Bucharest, where they've been living for the past several years, before returning there in March. Andrew faces 10 charges in the UK, including prostitution, rape, human trafficking and assault, linked to three alleged victims, while Tristan faces similar charges tied to a single alleged victim. They also face criminal investigations in Romania, which British officials say must be closed before the brothers can be extradited to the UK. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marx in London.
Closer to home, President Trump has pardoned a once popular reality TV couple convicted of bank fraud and tax evasion. Todd and Julie Chrisley have been in separate prison facilities since 2022 after being convicted of defrauding Atlanta area banks of $30 million and trying to hide their earnings from tax authorities. The couple, best known for the TV series Chrisley Knows Best, were often referred to as the Trumps of the South. Stocks finished lower across the board on Wall Street today, the Dow down about 0.5%. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Last week, the House of Representatives passed a sweeping budget bill that seeks to advance President Trump's agenda. It includes several provisions related to immigration, from border security to limiting who can get public benefits. NPR immigration policy reporter Ximena Bustillo has been covering this, and she's here in the studio. Hey there.
Hey, Ari.
So the package is now before the Senate, which could make changes, but tell us about the immigration-related efforts in the bill as it stands now.
The focus on immigration can really be divided up into three buckets. First, there's border security and enforcement funding. And this is the money that the Trump administration officials have been asking for. It includes about $45 billion for more funding for the wall construction down at the southern border with Mexico. And it includes billions more to increase detention space and hire more immigration enforcement personnel. Then we have a second bucket, which is the proposed fees for those applying for immigration services. This includes a fee on asylum, which is at $1,000. Currently, there's no fee to apply for asylum. And they want to increase any existing fees sharply by hundreds of dollars, particularly those related to filings in immigration court. And finally, we saw many changes that would limit access to federal public benefits, mainly limiting access to U.S. citizens or lawful permanent residents. That's things like food assistance, health care, and federal student aid. Estimates from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office say that up to 250,000 people would lose access to food assistance, and that includes asylum seekers, refugees, and those with parole or various other legal statuses.
So when you put all of those different moves together, what were House Republicans trying to accomplish through this package of changes?
These changes are really in line with President Trump's immigration agenda. His administration has been increasing the rate of arrests and detentions, and the administration has spent the first few months not just limiting illegal immigration, but finding ways to limit legal migration as well. Heidi Altman at the National Immigration Law Center said that they see these fees and penalties, as a way of almost punishing immigrant communities.
And that's how we see this provision as fitting into the administration's agenda, which is essentially to make life and well-being untenable for immigrants who are already here in the United States.
This sentiment of making life difficult also fits into the changes for public benefits. During House hearings and votes, Republican lawmakers argued that those without legal status were using this program, these programs. There's no evidence necessarily that that's true. People without legal status cannot apply for these federal benefits unless they're doing so on behalf of their U.S. citizen children. And the big sweepy bill doesn't address that and primarily targets immigrants here legally instead.
If we're talking about limits to public assistance and increases in fees, does that save taxpayer dollars?
Immigration experts say that legal immigrants already use public benefits at really low rates, so the savings attached with removing them are minimal. Here's Mark Krikorian from the Center for Immigration Studies, a group that advocates for more restrictive immigration policies.
It will have some effect in inducing some people to decide to pack up and go home, but both the fiscal effect and the immigration effect are likely to be pretty modest.
He says using public benefits isn't a significant incentive to immigrate to the U.S. either, so instead the impact is felt on families who exercise their ability to use these programs.
And just briefly, what's the Senate likely to do?
Well, senators have not generally commented on these provisions while more high-profile debates take place related to the spending. But kind of on that note, we have seen some GOP senators raise questions about how much money the administration really needs for border enforcement. For example, if $45 billion really is needed for a border wall. But senators have said generally many changes will come up and we'll be watching to see what they change in terms of how immigrant groups here legally could be affected.
NPR immigration policy reporter Ximena Bustillo, thank you.
Thank you.
Universe is the first K-pop group in the world to feature North Korean defectors. Its other members have roots in Laos, Thailand, China, Japan, and the U.S. They're the latest K-pop idols to market multiculturalism in this cutthroat industry. Hiryun Kang tells us more about this unusual group from Seoul.
When I meet Universe at their agency in Gangnam, a ritzy district in Seoul, the first thing I ask is how they overcome language barriers.
Body language.
Body language. That's vocalist Seok Kim, one of the North Korean members.
Hello, my name is Hyo. I'm from North Korea. I'm the rapper of Universe.
There's also the main dancer Aito Murata from Japan, Nathan Kusol, a Lao Thai computer science major from Arkansas, and last but not least...
Hi, my name is Kenny Howe. I'm from California, and I'm the personality hire.
This kind of diversity is no longer unusual in K-pop. Now, they all live together in a dorm in Seoul, chasing the K-pop dream. Look, I said I wonder who I be, 'cause have a name for me. The five members, who go professionally by their first names, all listened to different music as kids. Kenny grew up with the Beatles, Aito loved Justin Bieber, Nathan listened to Lao and Thai music, and the North Koreans?
처음 들었던 노래는...
Seok, who defected in 2019, listened to K-pop, illegally downloaded on USBs. He's from Yanggang province, bordering China, where foreign goods are smuggled in more easily. But Hyuk lived much further inland in Gyeongsang, a poorer region. Starting when he was just 9 years old, Hyuk cut down trees and even stole to survive, he says. Music was a luxury. The little he heard was state-sanctioned, like this revolution song. Hyuk was the first trainee to join Universe. It took executive producer Michelle Cho 6 years to find all the members. She tells me about conceiving of the group with her co-founder, Joe Lim.
Joe was thinking about, hey, do you think it'll be cool to like do a K-pop group with some North Koreans? Why not? If there's talented enough people, there is no reason why we can't do it.
Back then, Hyuk was working in restaurants and factories. When Michelle Cho met Hyuk, she said she heard talent in his voice. From there, her agency, Singing Beetle, held multiple auditions for the others. For each round, they received hundreds of applications from all over the world, despite being a small agency just starting out.
안녕하세요, Universe입니다.
Universe already has over 500,000 followers on TikTok, and their first single isn't even out yet. Online, they're very active, making silly reels, singing cover songs together, like Fools by Troye Sivan. Before defecting, Hyuk had never heard of South Korea, let alone Troye Sivan. He was just 13 in 2013 when he left his hometown, just 200 miles from Seoul, across one of the most fortified borders in the world. Today, he is one of some 30,000 North Korean defectors in South Korea. This song, Ordinary Person, was co-written by Hyuk. He raps in English, true to K-pop's strategy to reach a global audience. This is the only song the group has gone public with, as a teaser. Like other K-pop groups, Universe is very secretive about its official debut music. They won't tell me anything. The title, the lyrics, the dates, even the genres. Nathan just cheekily says,
"We can't wait to share our music."
We may know their multicultural backstories, but for now, the most important part of Universe, their sounds, is up to our imagination. For NPR News, I'm Haeryeon Kang from Seoul.
And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Archaeologists at the New York State Museum are piecing together a boat found deep in the muck at the site of the former World Trade Center. The boat dates back to the Revolutionary War. It was found 15 years ago and is now getting a permanent home, even though part of its journey to New York remains a mystery. John Campbell of member station WNYC reports.
A handful of workers are standing at a table in the New York State Museum in Albany. They're in the corner of a big, empty exhibit space, and they're surrounded by planks of old brown wood. One grabs a steamer and sprays some of the timber down. Another uses a Q-tip to carefully clean the muck out of every nook and cranny. On the other side of the room, archaeology student Angela Paola uses a handheld tool to grind away at a piece of foam.
We're currently just trying to get the platform for the keel leveled out. So once the keel is all level, we can actually start building the boat out from there.
She's talking about what's become known as the World Trade Center ship, a wooden boat found 22 feet below the surface at ground zero. The ship has been the talk of archaeologists since its discovery made national news in 2010. Since then, researchers have worked tirelessly to piece together its story. They analyzed rings in the wood grain to figure out it was likely built in Philadelphia in the 1770s, right around the Revolutionary War. And they know it was long buried by 1818, since landfill had turned water into shore by then. But there's still a lot they don't know.
What's the biggest unanswered question that you still have about this?
That button, how did it get into the boat?
That's Dr. Peter Fix, a research scientist at Texas A&M who's reconstructing the ship. He's talking about a small pewter button found in the boat inscribed with the number 52. He remembers chatting about it years ago with a museum curator.
And he said, well, we have this button, and the button is for a British regiment, 52nd a foot. How did that get in there? Then that piqued my brain.
That's about when researchers realized the boat was probably a gunship made for war, not a sloop or a cargo ship like they first thought. That button suggests the British captured it, but we don't know how or when it got to New York City.
How much time do you spend thinking about that button?
Probably too much.
For the next several weeks, Dr. Fix and a team of grad students will continue reconstructing the remnants of the boat for a permanent exhibit in the New York State Museum. Michael Lucas is the museum's historical archaeology curator. He says the public's invited to watch it all happen and ask questions of the people doing the work.
It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. You're not going to have an opportunity to see a 18th-century ship being constructed probably again in your life.
Once the boat is reassembled, the museum plans to make it the center of an exhibit on America's founding. The goal is to have it all ready for the 250th anniversary in 2026. For NPR News, I'm John Campbell in Albany.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. We'll be right back.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A quick spin around social media reveals people are seeing recession indicators everywhere when the restaurant Five Guys announced its first ever combo meal.
Child is getting so bad out here.
This is TikTok user The Simply Simone.
Little burger, little fry, and I believe a small drink. Baby, you know it's bad when Five Guys is actually rolling out combo meal.
The internet has flagged everything from job recruiter texts to hairstyle changes as recession indicators. Kenny Malone and Keith Romer from the Planet Money podcast checked in with economists to see if all this informal recession watching is lining up with the official data.
Are you familiar with the hip-hop artist Flava Flav?
I've heard the name. I
famously wore clocks around his neck.
Oh, okay.
This is economist Claudia Song.
Some astute viewer has noticed in a recent video his clock seems to have shrunk. Recession indicator. Thoughts?
Sounds like a good one.
There is a well-documented list of alternative recession indicators.
One theory says men's underwear sales decrease leading into a recession.
Another theory says lipstick sales increase because it's a relatively affordable luxury item.
But we do have more robust instruments, like a recession indicator Claudia Somm developed in 2019.
I put a really high priority on it's simple, could be put into policy, easily explained, and was highly reliable.
The Somm rule is that when unemployment rises by a certain amount, you can be almost certain the U.S. is already in a recession.
So currently, the Somm rule says what about a recession?
So currently, the Somm rule says we are not in a recession.
But that's about right now.
For the future, we turn to Professor Menzi Chin, who spent years studying our ability to forecast recessions.
I love talking about this. I talk about it with my students endlessly to their sadness, I'm sure.
Well, let me ask you this. Have you noticed that maybe your students are perhaps a bit more interested in talking about recession indicators?
Absolutely.
I would say possible recession indicator.
Yeah. Yes, I think you're right, actually.
Chin teaches at the University of Wisconsin, Madison.
And the specific indicator he's focused on?
The yield curve, or the more specifically, the term spread.
Meaning the relationship between interest rates on short-term and long-term government treasuries.
In normal times, investors demand higher interest for lending money for more time. But if that ever flips...
It signals a recession. And so it's a reflecting fact that people are expecting a slowdown.
And right now, Menzi Chin's yield spread model says there is a roughly 22% chance of a recession in the next 12 months.
Yes.
Okay. So is that feels high. Is that high?
Well, it's still below like a 50% threshold I would use.
You know, the truth is the hardest type of recession to predict is one that comes from an out of the blue shock. And the shock economists have been worrying about is a sudden global trade war.
So maybe social media is the right place to look after all. Just not TikTok or Instagram, but Truth Social and the account of one real Donald Trump, where the president may post about big new tariffs or big new trade deals. Keith Romer.
Kenny Malone.
NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Workday. Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward.
Among the hundreds of people cut from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention was one small team of researchers who doctors say were punching above their weight. The team was responsible for keeping clinicians up to date on contraception research, and many practitioners say they reference this research nearly every day. NPR's Katia Riddle explains.
Every doctor interviewed for this story said it's hard to overstate how much they rely on the CDC's guidelines when advising women on contraception.
I don't know. I mean, there is no other resource that is doing this. All the OBGYNs use it.
Dr. Andrea Braden is an obstetrician in Atlanta. The guidelines she's talking about are called the U.S. Medical Eligibility Criteria for Contraceptive Use. Eight researchers would look regularly at all the new science on birth control and make recommendations for doctors. A recent example Braden remembers is a change in guidance on breastfeeding for moms considering taking birth control pills.
They acknowledge the fact that, you know, there was possibly an increased risk of decreased milk supply in some moms.
busy doctors who are seeing many patients may not have time to comb through studies on breastfeeding. That's why the CDC made an app that doctors could download and easily reference with questions like these. The app was downloaded hundreds of thousands of times. Braden says this particular adjustment in the recommendations changed the conversation she has with women about breastfeeding.
In many moms, it should be considered that that might be a higher priority than, you know, contraception.
For some patients and doctors, the stakes can be life or death in conversations around birth control. Dr. Lydia Pecker is an expert on sickle cell disease at Johns Hopkins University. When treating patients who have this inherited red blood cell disorder, she says she has to think carefully about what kinds of contraception to prescribe.
The ones that contain estrogen, which is the pill, the patch, the ring, are considered less safe, significantly less safe for women with sickle cell disease because of the increased risk of blood clots that those methods carry.
Patients with sickle cell disease already have a high risk of blood clots. Using estrogen-based contraception can increase this risk. Pecker says she mostly stopped prescribing these methods of birth control after this research emerged.
And that you really should have like a significant conversation with patients about sort of risks and benefits in that setting.
The most recent guidelines were updated in 2024. Those guidelines do still exist, even though the entire team that regularly updates them does not. The Trump administration offered no explanation as to why they cut this team. Dr. Braden in Atlanta says in medicine, if recommendations are not regularly updated, they're quickly out of date.
And new data comes out, new research comes out, and then we find out that there's a better way to do things, and contraceptive medicine is no different from that.
Patients won't necessarily know, she says, when they could have been getting better information, but she thinks that when the team that issued these recommendations was cut, it was a blow to women everywhere.
It really hurt those of us in women's health to target something like contraceptives. You know, I mean, this is basic healthcare for OBGYNs, and it was really defeating. It was very, I would say, I felt angry and sad and confused.
She and other doctors point out that many women in the U.S. can no longer legally terminate pregnancy. They say that makes it especially important for them to be able to make an informed choice about the best ways to prevent pregnancy. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography, Kauffman.org. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Give you a little experience of some young